I'm Jonathan. I'm an alcoholic.
Jonathan. Lots and lots and lots. And whole bunches.
I had a moment where I was terrified that wasn't going to happen, and I was just going to be sitting here in silence. Well, my stats. I'm 32. I got sober when I was 27. And that's 10,029 days of life, 27 and a half. So it's going to be a while before I reach the golden half and half moment. But my sobriety date is July 13th, 2009. My first AA meeting was a week before that. But I decided that it was important to get rid of my alcohol by drinking all of it. And then about 4 months later, I remembered that the day before that, I had gotten incredibly high. So high that I forgot. Which was the goal, usually. It started medicinally for about 2 weeks, and then I remember this very clear moment. Oh, I'm addicted now. Oh, well. So, I have a home group. It's the Park City Men's Stag. Meets Thursday nights in Park City at 7 o'clock. It's fantastic. I find that having a variety of meetings is incredibly helpful to my sobriety. I go to a couple of young people meetings. One is heavier on the recovery. One is heavier on the fellowship, my home group. And I do a jail meeting once a week because I never got caught and I should have been in jail for a very long time. So I've been doing that for about 3.5 years. My self-imposed sentence probably has a couple of years left on it. I come from Southern California, if you're old enough, from Fox's The O.C., though that show was filmed in Malibu. It's more like Arrested Development, where we're all fairly self-obsessed and looking over each other's shoulders for something better. That's how I experienced it. It felt like there was a constant competition and that I was not keeping up. I still kind of feel that when I go home. Every time I go back, I get a little bit better. Either I think less of there being a competition or less of caring. I think I prefer the latter. My family was not particularly unusual. My parents were divorced when I was 3. I was raised by my mom with my sister. And she worked 3 jobs to pay for my sister and I to do extracurricular activities. I had lots of opportunities. I never really wanted for money or anything, so I can't say that I was driven to drink or use drugs out of trauma or coping. My first drink was actually a friend of mine just asking me, do you want to drink? And I heard, do you want to get drunk? And I said, yes, mostly because I thought that our friendship was contingent upon it. And we'd already been friends for a while, so I don't know where it came from. And so we drank some Goldschlager, and it was absolutely disgusting. And my first thought was, I'm going to have to get used to this. Don't know where that thought came from. Second was, I need a chaser, and I don't know how I knew what that was. And it was grapefruit juice, which I hate, but I had to do something about it. Not drinking it didn't occur to me. And I don't remember, but we went to the jacuzzi behind my house, no other memories. Addiction began for me about 5 or 6 years before that. My first love was online video games, because there, anonymity is a warm blanket that I could wrap myself in and be whoever I wanted. And anytime anything became uncomfortable, I just log off and go back to the real world, which I hated. But it was nice to know that there was an escape. And the way that people talk about their first drink, first ever, or the first drink of the evening or the morning or whatever, and feeling wonderful, that was exactly how I experienced logging onto a game. And I did not, once I got to AA, I did not think I was an alcoholic. I'll regale you with why later. But I didn't start my timer. I have a tendency to go too long. I didn't think I was an alcoholic, and there's a part very early on where it says, the book says, frothy emotional appeals seldom suffice. You know, the please, please, why are you doing this to us? You're hurting the family, yourself, blah, blah, blah. My sponsor asked, did anybody ever do that for me? And I said, well, no, they didn't really know that I was drinking or getting high. I sort of hid myself from them. But I thought about it for a minute. They never shut up about the games. And it's like, you don't understand what this is for me, and you don't understand what it is in general, so leave me alone. And immediately I realized my drinking was just the most recent thing, that I had actually been doing addiction for about 17 years. And that was a, well, fuck moment. Over the 15 years of my playing games, I racked up about four and a half years of played time, where of my waking life, that's 8 or 9 years. I didn't really miss the waking life because at school, I didn't have friends and I did not feel liked, mostly because some people would say to me, nobody likes you, you know that, right? And I don't know if that was true of everybody, but I certainly took it to heart and hated them back. I got into fights, suspended a lot. I just didn't understand what was happening to my life. I was in one school and started getting bullied and probably deserved some of it, at least. I believe I was a little shit. And then middle fourth grade, forcibly transferred to another school. Pretty strict, using the word like incorrectly, which is incredibly common in Orange County. Got you 10 push-ups. One time I was suspended and I had to do 500 push-ups, jumping jacks, and sit-ups, and then I was suspended for 3 days. But, of course, it was all incredibly unfair and I didn't deserve any minute of it. The principal was an ex-Marine, so he wasn't just pulling this out of nowhere. But that was kind of abusive. I had other abusive teachers. It was just part of a pattern of what is happening to my life. Why are you people doing this? At one point, that principal said, you need to stop playing the victim. And I said, I am the victim. I'm not playing. And he was not interested in that. So I pretty much gave up on friends and fitting in by about seventh grade, and giving up felt really nice. Knowing that I was going to high school and that I wouldn't have to see most of those people ever again was a huge relief. And then I went to high school, realized I had not learned how to make friends, so I signed up for Latin and the Junior Classical League, and it's like institutionalized isolation and separation. Why are you learning Latin? It's a dead language for the SATs. It's the only answer we ever had. I never took the SATs. After high school, I'd had a plan to, it was a vague plan. I never really made plans, still don't. But what I would call a plan back then was to become a Marine. The principal was not my inspiration for that. There was the janitor who befriended me in a very Saturday morning special kind of way. It was just like teaching me how to live, but not really. He taught me how to work with computers. And I looked up to him, and so I was going to do that. Anyway, I'm gay, so that doesn't really work out. It does now, but back then it didn't. Without a plan, I went to community college. That's what you do when you don't have a plan. It's just what's next. And I actually went a little bit early because halfway through my junior year of high school, I'd had enough of that bullshit too and transferred to an independent study and graduated a semester early. Would have been a year early, but independent study where I'm from is an hour of school and 20 hours of homework and another 20 hours of work. You know, turn in your pay stubs and prove that that's happening. And my first semester there, I just wasn't interested and had to convince them to allow me to continue going there. Semester early, started community college, immediately did not know what I wanted to do. Took an electrical engineering class where we put little wires together and wrote like 80 lines of code so that it would make the French police siren sound. And I thought, this is fun, with no practical application. And I was doing computer science classes. I was the kid on the block who knew how to fix your computer because I just spent all of my time with them. Again, video games. And I was also taking freshman, sophomore English. Teacher saw me writing my essays in the hallway right before class, and she pulled me aside at one point and said, you're going to have to improve on that. But your essays are good, and after reading 60, I also appreciate that they're funny. And I really liked that. Someone was praising me for something. I didn't really get a lot of that. So I switched to English. And 4 years later, as a super senior of 6 years, I graduated with an English degree. I am now an IT professional, of course. Cannot escape what I was wired to do. Occasionally I will write things, but they are all lies, and that's what I was trained to do in English. Analysis and lie. Sound convincing. So it's entirely possible that all this is false. And a friend of mine said, I'm obsessed with citing sources, but a friend of mine used the line, we're all plagiarists. And I have found that to be true. I have understood my story in sobriety by telling it here and there, but mostly by hearing it from other places. Nobody's ever told my exact story. I don't know how common that is for other people, but piecing it together, mostly the experience of life, that's what I have heard. I don't think I'm going to stumble onto somebody who spent 9 years of their waking life playing video games only to lose all joy and pleasure in that and end up drinking and smoking pot just to stay alive. Someone else could have that story, but you know, computer people are reclusive and shy and suspicious and jealous of other people, so we don't talk about it. So I was at that community college for a couple of years until I was sick of it. I only move on from stuff when I'm sick of it, and I usually spend at least a year of waiting for that to change. Never does. I met somebody who was working at my job for a summer, and in the language that I know now, I would say that he had what I wanted. He was just incredibly happy. He enjoyed life. He went to BYU. I was raised Mormon, but where I'm from, there were 8 of us in a school of 2,600. And so I didn't have the experience of growing up in what I thought was my community. So I decided to do what this guy did. And I came to Utah to my great aunt's funeral in January, turned 22, and decided I'm going to change stuff. Put together a 90-day plan to wrap up my life, go around to my teachers and beg and plead for grade changes so that I could be admitted to BYU. That one teacher who convinced me to change majors said that the grade that I got was already generous and that she would not be submitting a change. And I was so embarrassed, I said thank you very much, and I left. It was a 90-day plan split into three 30-day parts. I don't remember what the middle part was. But the night before leaving, I was out to dinner with my friends. I had somehow made friends at that point. It was a group thing where you just sort of glom on and get absorbed into it. I was out to dinner, and one of them said, I'll see you later. And I suddenly realized, no, you won't. I'm moving tomorrow morning. I hadn't told anybody. It completely slipped my mind. That's apparently how important they were to me. And I felt pretty bad about that. And then 6 a.m. the next morning with my little VW Beetle packed with my stuff. Gave my mom a hug, which she was not comfortable with, and moved. We don't hug in my family or touch or say that we love each other. We just sort of assume that it's true. And that's because, in my case, because when I was in second or third grade, one of my teachers asked my mom, "How do you put up with him?" And she said, "I have to. He's my son." So I've just been riding off of that ever since. I moved and went to BYU as a guest student and was immediately disappointed on so many levels. The education was okay, but my English teacher said, "Okay, we're going to read some poetry now by a lesbian. I hope everybody's okay with that." And mortified, I looked around and nobody else was, and I thought, "Oh my God, I'm the crazy one according to them." I had to take religion classes, which wasn't that bad, but in the Mormon religion, in the mythology, at some point, the bad people have their skin darkened. And he had a whole slide saying, "There is no modern corollary to this." Apparently, he's encountered racism so much that he had to put together a PowerPoint presentation on it not being a thing, like people assumed. So, disappointment there. I was a guest student. Anybody can be a guest student in the spring and summer terms. I did have a teacher that was a visiting professor. She was fantastic. And at the end of the semester, I had her for two classes. She made one class breakfast and another class lunch. She used to live on a commune, was used to cooking for a lot of people. It was just wonderful. In my first year of sobriety, I moved to what could be called a commune or a hippie co-op. Randomly, that was my transition living. It was wonderful. So connections there for me. And then BYU did not take me as a full-time student. And I tried to beg and plead with them, and they were not budging at all. They did not care that I wanted to go and live among my community. So in that week, I got rejected from BYU. I tried to give blood. My mom's a nurse, and I was just felt obligated to give blood. It's just what you do. And I filled out the questionnaire, and they said, "You can't give blood. The Red Cross will not accept it because I've had sexual contact with a man." It's like, "Yeah, of course I have. I have a letter saying that I can never give blood." And my bishop there said that he didn't really know what to do with me, so I was kind of on probation. I had had you have to have an ecclesiastical endorsement to go to BYU, and I'd gotten one back home. They knew everything about me. One of the guys was there at my baby blessing. His family has known my family forever and ever. His cousin is a really high bigwig in the church, and this little shit bishop in Provo, Utah said, "Maybe not." So I felt like reacting dramatically and saying, "In a week, I've been rejected in mind, body, and spirit. Oh, my life." In the same week, I found an apartment for $250 a month in Salt Lake and got accepted to Westminster, and they were throwing money at me as a transfer student because they love transfer. I still wanted to be dramatic, though. I was kind of disappointed. And when I did go up there, I was disappointed again because I just had this idea of what school was and also what my life is supposed to be, and it just wasn't that. I couldn't have articulated what I wanted it to be, though. It was every time I've been profoundly disappointed in life, it was just because I don't know what I want, but it's not this. And I don't know where that comes from. That gets more into psychology, and that's not what we do here. If you think your sponsor is your therapist, you need to reconsider that. Unless they actually are therapists, but then still, I think there's some ethical thing with treating you. My sponsor is my spiritual advisor, not my financial or relationship advisor, which is great. It'd be weird, because then I would resent him, and I can't do that. I can't resent my sponsor and trust him to say everything. So I graduated from college. By that point, video games had been ruined for me by just bad experience. Apparently, over the previous 4 or 5 years, I had become an asshole and arrogant. And I would say It's not arrogant if you're right, and it's not ego if it's accurate. And I said these things. I said these things unironically, because I thought, but I am right, and I have all of the talent, and you people are coming along with me. I said those things too, out loud. Out loud. It wasn't voice chat back then. And people were sick of it by the end. And I didn't understand that. I was so dedicated. When I was in the community college, I took a semester off to focus on the game, on what really mattered. And that's probably one of the reasons why I had to beg for grade improvements. So I stopped playing, and then I graduated, and I had no purpose in life. I had an English degree, which there's really a booming job market for those. And I got a job at a call center because I had lots of student debt and was terrified of defaulting on any of it. My stepmom had co-signed on one of my loans, and so there was terror in that, too, of putting that responsibility on her. So I got a call center job, hated it, felt that I was better than it, and I had resumed drinking. I don't know if you know this, but you can't drink or do drugs when you go to BYU. They kind of frown upon it. You also have to shave every day, which I did not care for. And so at Westminster, I'd gotten back into the drinking. And especially on midterm trips, one to France, one doing earthworks of the American Southwest. Lots of drinking, lots of getting high. Pretty typical of those trips. So that was the only thing I had to do. Call center, get drunk. And then after 6 months of that, when I had to leave work to go and get fitted for my cap and gown, and did not come back. That I'm better than this feeling took control. And I spent a couple of weeks unemployed, terrified, and ended up getting a job that I still have today. I don't know why. They've been incredibly patient with me. Had that for 2 years. Mental health deteriorated. Increased the pot intake, like I said, medicinally. And then it became daily non-habit-forming marijuana. And it helped because it allowed me to smile and to eat and to do what I called enjoy life, but it's not the same thing. Chemical-induced happiness is not happiness. I also think the same thing of hallucinogenics. Chemical-induced spiritual experiences are not the real thing. You see some pretty stuff, but if you sleep long enough, you'll see some pretty stuff that way, too. Louis C.K. has a joke of your brain runs out of stuff to do, and after about 8 hours, just says to you, you want to see some shit? And my world kept shrinking, and it became the size of the Papasan bowl chair that I sat in, with chips and donuts and drinks within reach, and my TV. I've seen seasons 1 through 6 or 7 of Family Guy, 30 Rock, Futurama, a number of other shows, like 15, 20 times, because I would just come home, get high, watch, and I can't laugh at them anymore. It's just like I go through and it's like, that's funny, that's funny. I remember that being funny. And occasionally, people would come over and there would be parties. There's a perfect picture of me at one of these parties. I'm dressed in the uniform of what I wanted to be, a tweed jacket with elbow patches, glass of wine, and a book by David Rakoff, bright red, called Fraud. It's the epitome of what I was. That went on for a bit. I'd also developed at that time sex and love addiction. And I just get attached to emotionally unavailable people. It's more the love addiction side. The distinction is a little confusing, and I think even the 4 or 5 fellowships that try to address it are not clear on what they're doing. Because people come in, they're confused, they spawn another fellowship. Let's try this again. It's like how new meetings get started. Resentment in a coffee pot. And I started having regular nervous breakdowns. There was one where I couldn't eat solid foods for a month, and I flew home to talk to my old psychiatrist to talk about antipsychotics and other things to keep me going. Ended up on lithium and something else. I don't know what. Lithium takes many months to stabilize, and after 2 weeks, like, I'm gonna smoke more pot. I need it now. Looking back, I know that my world was small and that people were giving me that look of pity that you can't argue with more frequently. But I thought that I was doing fine and that I was just living a difficult life, dealing with the circumstances that I was given. And then occasionally I would have these moments of clarity where, for whatever reason, I thought, maybe it's time to go to AA. And I really didn't know. I was not an alcoholic. I don't know why AA was in my head. I'd gone to Al-Anon when I was 19 or 20 with a friend, or because of a friend. I went to an NA meeting with him, was just horrified by all those stories. Like, what have you people done? And so 7 or 8 years later, I have AA ringing in my ears. A friend of mine that I drank with had come over to my house at one point. I was getting high right in front of him, and he asked me, do you think you might be addicted? And I couldn't lie to him, and I said, maybe. And that echoed in my brain for a long time. But May of 2009, I decided to go on a trip to Goblin Valley to try and do as they did in the Bible, fast and pray in the desert and have words with God. I get hypoglycemic really easily, and so fasting and praying led that evening to shock and having a friend take off my clothes and stuff me in a sleeping bag with a very pretty lesbian, but you know, completely wasted on me. I was shaking uncontrollably, and like, this is so mortifying. I wanted to refuse treatment because I was just embarrassed. I have all the niceness and shame of being Midwestern, but I'm from Southern California, so I don't know where that came from. And I had been wandering around in the heat, drinking lots of water, flushing all the electrolytes that I desperately needed out of my system, and trying to talk to God, getting no answers, just over and over again. What do you want from me? And so, yeah, no answer, come back, disappointed. July 4th rolls around, and I had befriended someone who worked wilderness rehab and had overdosed on heroin twice in a month. He was abusing another drug. I've since learned that that's kind of typical of rehabs that people are using. Very interesting. Trusting kids to those people. And so my thought was, and his roommate had moved out in the middle of the night. I had helped him. He moved in with me. So I wanted to help this guy feel better. That meant going out and drinking. That was the only tool that I had for feeling better, for anything. And so we did. And went to the first bar, and they only served beer. And we drank beer in disgust and resentment of, how dare you not serve liquor? I was such a snob. I didn't drink beer until my last year of drinking because it's like disgusting, and what's the point? Because liquor's more efficient. Bacardi 151, that's what gets the job done. It's all disgusting, so what does it matter? Okay, perfect. We went to another bar, And it was a dive bar called Ex-Wives Club. Decent pool, but that's not what we were there for. Sat down, ordered some drinks. Liquor laws are weird in Utah, and there had recently been a new one where you can't have a shot of something, of a liquor the same color as the one in your mixed drink. And again, resentful and hating, but only taking half a second to adjust, we ordered different combinations because we're professional drinkers. We know how to get it done. Drank a lot, went into the back area, back patio, and we're smoking, and I said, we should probably go soon because I'm about 20 minutes away from being too drunk to drive. I was thinking in the future. It was actually in the past where I had become unsafe to drive. I drove drunk a lot, one of the many things that should have landed me in jail. Never got caught. I don't know why. I was arrogant about that. Like, I drive so well when I'm drunk. And there were fireworks, and I was looking up like, what the hell is going on? I did not realize it was the 4th of July, and that means fireworks. So disconnected from the world. The next day, I was sitting on my back porch talking to another friend, saying, what else can we do for this guy before he goes home to rehab? I knew that he was going home to rehab. He had been fired. And I did not hear myself, but my friend did. And he just looked at me with pity and said, you are in no position to help anyone. And I couldn't argue with him. I just stared, gaping, mouth gaping, just like, what? Oh, fuck. And the deepest sigh of, I called my friend that had asked me about possibly being addicted to weed. And I had looked at the AA schedule a few other times, and I would look at those addresses, and they would make no sense. And I would forget that Google Maps existed, despite being a programmer who frequently took advantage of it. And just, I didn't want to go. Some deep part of me did not want me to go. So I called my friend and said, what meeting will you be at? I will meet you there. And how do I get there? Repeat it 3 more times. And the next day, I met him at a meeting in Park City. It was a 12 and 12. They were on step 3, and it was a closed meeting. And he said that you have to be an alcoholic to come to these things. And I was trying to practice honesty because I didn't really understand at that point what was going on in my life. And I thought if I just try and be honest, I'll figure it out. It'll reveal itself to me. So I said, I don't want to do that because I'm not an alcoholic. I don't want to lie. And he said, there's an old timer who's not here today, but he usually kind of makes a stink about it. So you might want to do it anywhere. And anyway, and they're going around the room reading, and it got to me. And I said, I'm an alcoholic. I said it exactly the way my friend did, but I choked on the alcoholic word. And just in general felt nervous in that meeting, which is a sign that I was in the right place, because if I wasn't, I would not care what anybody in that room thought of me. And I read, and I don't know what I read, because I was just so concerned with not stammering or passing out from not breathing. And left feeling incredibly productive. I have no memory of anything that was said in the meeting. And I felt like I knew about the 12 steps going in, but I would stare at the list. None of it would click. I was someone who slogans, cliches were made for, because that was the length of my memory. And I just had a general feeling of excitement. Like, I don't think that I'm an alcoholic, but I feel like this is the first time I've done something productive for my life. And it's the biggest fellowship, so I'm going to come here, kind of like triage, figure out what's wrong with me, and then go where I really need to be. And so it was a Monday. That the Saturday after that, I was at home, and a bunch of people were over smoking pot. One of them asked me if I wanted to, and I said yes, but it's AA, I don't know if it's okay. And so he asked me again, do you want to get high? And I said, of course I do. And this is the thing that took me a while to remember. And then I did. And then the next day I thought, maybe I shouldn't have done that. Opened my cupboard and there's all this booze in there. And I thought, I'm in AA now. It probably isn't appropriate to have all of this here. But my mom didn't raise me to waste. So, glug, glug. And the next day I went to my second meeting and my friend wasn't there, but that strict old timer was, and I was terrified of him. And he just asked me, he introduced himself. He asked me casually if I was still drinking, just because he didn't recognize me. And I said, yes, so proudly because of my plan. And I told him, like, yes, but to get rid of it. And he gave me the pity stare. And I did not know this man, so I did not have any information to go off of to manipulate him into agreeing with my brilliant plan. And he just kept looking at me, and I was crushed, forced to face the reality of, wait, why didn't I just throw it out? My mom didn't raise me to waste. Who cares? I mean, AA, why do I need alcohol? Step four, I remember it that time. And it talks about the way that we were living, just so hopeless and hateful of everybody, the world being small. And it was eerie because it could have been one of my journal entries, which I only wrote when things were really bad. Great despair today, darkness creeping in. Which is how Bill wrote the 12 and 12, because he was incredibly depressed when he did so. So I was crushed after that. I was confronted with the truth, and then I had an hour of very strong identification, and I went outside after the meeting, was just smoking, and like, what the hell just happened? So I can actually say my sobriety day is July 13th, 6 p.m., because since then, that began the total shutdown and reboot of my psyche, my identity, everything. I stopped talking because I couldn't trust that any of the words coming out of my mouth were true. I realized I had totally lost perspective on who I was, because I saw that there was another force inside of me that was able to speak with my voice and wear my skin, go around doing stuff, that it didn't ask me for permission, and I was forced to just watch. And I would occasionally think that I had negotiation power, but really it was just convincing me to shut up and go along with it. And I had to, because if I was fighting it the whole time, my brain would shatter. I've heard there's lots of definitions of sanity, but there's only the one of insanity, that the brain creates an alternate version of reality to protect itself from damage in times of trauma. And as an alcoholic, I have the ability to induce that trauma whenever I want to. And that our behavior is like schizophrenics. That even, like, we're just absolutely crazy sober, but even once I decide to drink, like, I get in the car to go and buy alcohol or make the call to have pot delivered because I was too afraid to go out and get it myself. And I was a snob, only smoked the finest organic free trade, shade grown, whatever, delivered to me. I did that with alcohol, too. I drank expensive stuff. It was how I controlled it and made myself think that I'm not an alcoholic, or I'm certainly not a stoner. How dare you? Quality only, just like in the movies. And so I had the shutdown, and my friend came back the next week and suggested that I come to this other meeting, the men's meeting, and I decided to not only try and tell the truth all the time, but to say yes to stuff. And I went to that men's meeting a couple of weeks. There was one guy who could really tell that I was new and that I did not want to be spoken to or touched in any way, spiritually or physically. And so he would beeline for me and say hello and shake my hand and give me a big hug. And I know that he could tell because later on he would say, remember when you used to hate this? Say, yes, come here, big guy. And he asked me if I wanted to go to this group's annual campout. And in my head, screaming no, I said, yes, how much is it? It was $40, and I paid. And, like, well, my God, what have I obligated myself to? The following weekend, I was in the High Uintas, parked in a single line behind three locked gates, realizing there is no escape. I am here for the weekend. And my friend had gone with me, but he laughed halfway through, so I was just left with 30 guys that I did not know. And around a campfire, having a meeting, apparently. Still did not know how any of this worked. Like, we're talking about stuff. I guess this is a meeting. And it got to me, and I just said, I'm so afraid of being here. I don't know you guys. I can't get out. And I'm just stuck with you and myself. I don't know what to do. And they were very welcoming. I don't remember really anything that they said. It was just getting through the weekend, partially because it was really cold. It snowed on Saturday in August, and I was wearing shorts, I think, and had a summer sleeping bag and tent, and one of the guys had brought extra stuff and let me use it. It was very nice of him. So came back, and at that point, I still couldn't read the 12 steps and know what I had just read, but I did hear, get a sponsor. And so after the next meeting, I went up to a guy who seemed to be able to share in the way that I wanted to, honestly, and without shame about his emotions, and I asked him, will you be my sponsor, and then will you tell me what a sponsor is? Because I was terrified at that point of being kicked out of AA. Not being able to grasp the complex topic of 12 single or double sentence steps. I certainly could not hear the traditions, which said that everybody's a member when they say they are, and we can't kick anybody out. So when I heard do this or do that, I took it as commands. And he said yes, and he told me, but I take this shit really seriously, and I want you to write down 10 ways that you're powerless, in 10 ways that your life is unmanageable, regardless of alcohol or substance or behavior, and then go to 90 meetings in 90 days. And his tone was so serious, and I was like, maybe I've overreacted. But I was also terrified that he was going to beat me up, because by then it was like a commitment. And so I did what he said, and I wrote those 20 things and saw, yeah. Fuck me. And I went to 27 meetings, and then I can't remember why, but I missed a day. And the next day, I was at bowling after a meeting, and was just freaking out. And a guy said, well, it just means you're going to drink. And I looked at him, thought, should I be terrified? No, it was a joke. And I laughed for the first time in sobriety. And felt relief and realized also that the 90-90 thing was just to get into the habit, and I was in the habit at that point. There was a legitimate reason that I missed the day before. And so I stopped stressing about going every day. A few months later, somebody asked me what meetings I got to, and I named them and realized I was going every day. It had become the fulfilling part of my life. The arrangement with that sponsor didn't really work out, so I got another one, because after a meeting in the parking lot, he had gotten a service position that I wanted. Someone said that our central office needed a new website person, and since it was my career, I was rushing towards it. I can't do anything else because it all involves talking to people and, you know, touching, but websites, there's no people involved. But he got to it first, and so I chased him out and wanted to tell him all my great ideas, and he responded the way you're supposed to a crazy person chasing you into the parking lot. Do you have a sponsor? And I said, no, I'm kind of looking for one, looking for inspiration in my next home group meeting, blah, blah, blah. basically, let's not talk about it. And he said, well, I would be happy to sponsor you. If you don't find anything, here's my email address. And a couple days later, Park City, no inspiration. So I emailed him, let's do it. Turns out, he was my friend's sponsor, too. And he had the same degree that I did. And his book collection was more vast and obscure than my own. And I realized, I am not going to be able to pull off anything in front of this guy. This is perfect. All of my intellect, all of my references and deflections, he knows them too. And he's going to call bullshit on me. And he still does, because I try. For another addiction, I asked him, like, when does this end? And he said, you can get off the elevator anytime you want to. And I said, that's not an elevator, that's a paternoster, which is a platform. And he said, well, that wasn't really a question then, it was a cone, which is like, what's the sound of one hand clapping? I was like, God damn it. You with the brains. Most of the time when I talk to him, I'm able to leave my brain outside. And that's very important because then I can speak honestly. And for a while, my sponsor was the only one that I could do that with. But so we started meeting once a week, reading the book, doing steps when we got to it. There was not paperwork. He said he gave me his lineage, which was 4 or 5 hops to Bill, and he said, we're going to do it the way they did it. The only things you're going to write down are your inventory and your 8th step. And I was at his house one Sunday, and he was answering central office phones and got a call from a trucker who needed a ride to a meeting. Gave me the address and said, off you go. And so that was the first AA service thing that I did, because he didn't give me the website. 2.5 years later, because the website was so awful, I said, give me the goddamn password. And I took it from him. But before that, it was just doing service. He did not say, would you like to go and give this guy a ride to a meeting? Just gave me the address, said go. So service was not optional. I still believe that. The coins say service right there, Unity Service Recovery. And it doesn't say, if you feel like it, maybe, why not? If you have time in your busy schedule. And there were slogans to back that up. Can't let the life that AA has given me get in the way of my life in AA. Half of the people in AA are concerned with our common welfare, and the other half live off of that welfare. And the people who are invested in their sobriety stay sober. The ones who aren't, don't. Very simple formula. And it's not, it could be a karmic thing of give back what you were given, but mostly it's just I need to rehearse my addiction, going to meetings, hearing my story, or just hearing what it's still like out there, and remember or realize where I am now. My time is irrelevant. I think all sobriety time is irrelevant. It's hard to get, and it's nice to have, but I see old-timers saying ridiculous things, and they're so angry, and why? How have you been sober? And maybe AA is not a real thing, because you're awful. And newcomers save lives, saying to me, as long as I'm not in a prideful place, saying stuff to me that just unlocks stuff that has been bothering me for so long. Like when I was quitting cigarettes, trying to, I said, I'm powerless over this stuff, but I don't get unmanageability. And he said, it's not connected to that. A bag of Skittles to me is unmanageable. And like, oh yeah, it's everything. My life is unmanageable. I can't manage the addiction. That would be awful. That's like the alcohol thing of, well, my liver can handle 1 ounce an hour, so I'm just going to drink 1 ounce an hour. That's miserable. Why would anybody do that to themselves? I'm only going to smoke 1 cigarette a day, and the rest of the time I'm going to murder everybody around me. My experience of that emotion was, I'm going to shoot you in the kneecaps to teach you a lesson. I take no pleasure in this, but you must learn. My anger was always fairly passive-aggressive, sometimes slipping into aggressive-aggressive. But mostly it was turned towards myself. I am my harshest critic. Anybody who is as mean to me as I am to myself would be beaten until bloody and worse. But that doesn't happen. Nobody can be as mean to me as I am to myself. So, doing the steps. About 4 months in, I start talking because somebody asked me to close a meeting, which just is saying the word God. But it was a significant moment for me because somebody remembered my name, which meant that he noticed me coming to the meeting repeatedly. And I had not felt noticed in a long time. And beaming with a smile, I said, God, and everybody else like saying the rest of it. And then a little while after that, I was asked to share something. And then I don't know what I shared, but I became immediately neurotic after that of, I have to come up with something before so I don't look like an idiot. In case you can't tell, I no longer prepare. This is just off the top of my head, and I sometimes like to say, lower your expectations and we'll get through this. But I forgot to. I was doing inventory. I went to a conference up in Park City, and there was a speaker who was wearing a Hawaiian shirt, which was a mark against him, and he was speaking like a motivational speaker, which to me was not honest, so another mark against him, and the things that he was saying were ridiculous. And I'm writing my inventory at the same time, and I suddenly realized, they're connected. And I wrote him down, and like, what I resent, and then where I'm selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, fearful, where I'm to blame. And I hear some people do the inventory a little bit different, where they don't write as much, but I really needed to itemize each and everything. Because I was always those five things in my resentments. And that was the first time where it's like, I'm getting ahead of the resentment before it festers. It was always something bad happens or I make a bad decision and then I call my sponsor. And just little by little, I reach the call my sponsor before I do it. And I was kind of frustrated with my progress because it seemed so slow. But I decided I'm very familiar with games, spending so much time on there, just clicking for 8 hours to get one skill point. And I decided every day was another skill point. And I was leveling up constantly. It was so rewarding. It was the opposite of when I started smoking and I was counting the cigarettes. And after 100, I thought, I'm not doing this anymore. So in recovery, counting the days, that was very nice. Occasionally, I still count days. It's something like 1750 now. I don't know. Like I said, it doesn't matter. Sometimes I'm crazy. Sometimes I'm not. I've heard the reason the program works is because we're not all crazy on the same day. And I've been suicidal in recovery. I felt like times were worse than before, and I've called my sponsor and said, why am I doing this? What's the point again if I'm worse than before? And he said, because you know the way out. And so your job right now is to go find a newcomer with whom you identify very closely and maybe feel worse than, and say that I actually know what to do about this, so let's do it together, and I will sponsor you, and we'll see where it goes. None of the people I've sponsored have stayed sober, but I also learned I will never get anybody sober or get them drunk. It's just not up to me. So as far as my sponsorship stats go, they're not great, but I also don't care. People keep asking me, that's nice. I feel like if it was a baseball card and they saw my batting average, they probably wouldn't ask, but thankfully, thankfully the second A precludes us from printing such things. So about 5 months in, I realize I'm slacking on my inventory. I say a little prayer. I want to recommit to this. Like, I really want to do this. And I get that enthusiasm. The next day, I get a promotion, which ended up being a bad thing. I got no pay increase and lots more work to do, and ended up costing the company a lot of money from not doing a good job. But I did get the willingness to complete the inventory, and it became important to me to finish it before I got 6 months. So I did a couple weeks before that. Hopped into my sponsor's car, completely demoralized and hating myself, with 36 pages of resentments, fears, and relationship inventory. Spent 6 hours driving to Wendover and back, and then around the University of Utah so that I could read the whole thing. The instructions say in a general way, but I was in a very specific way with lots of repetition to the point that he would stop me every once in a while and say, how can these 3 pages be merged into one thing? And I was a little offended because I wanted to get all that out, really let it be known where they had wronged me. But by the end of it, I felt what I can call now serenity and relief, but it felt like I had been hit in the face with a soccer ball, which happened a lot when I was younger because I wasn't any good at soccer. I could run fast, but I couldn't kick or pass the damn thing, so I just got hit in the face. It's a numbness, a disorientation of what is happening to me right now. And I went home and I did 6 and 7. I think I might have fallen asleep during 6, very common. Or maybe I entered a sort of nirvana trance state. Either way, I hadn't missed anything. I almost missed something in my inventory. I finished my list, and he said, is there anything else? And I realized I had left the biggest thing off. And I went through those questions live because I didn't want to say it. Once I realized I'd left something off, I didn't want to do it because there was so much shame bound up in it. And I also knew that if I didn't, I would not stay sober. And so I did. So after 6, I did 7, which takes all of 30 seconds, and felt nothing and thought, maybe this is a fake thing. But then the next morning, I was driving to work and a song came on that had the word surrender in it, and it said it, and I immediately broke down. I had been trying to cry those previous 6 months, couldn't do it. It's like, I'm so filled with grief and sadness, why am I not crying? I deserve it, and also the universe deserves seeing me grieve, not grieve, suffer. I was enthusiastic to do the inventory too, because I felt like I deserved the suffering. So next morning, to a pop song, I'm driving on the freeway, weeping dangerously. And it wasn't even the right lyric. I totally misheard it. So 2 weeks later, I got 6 months. I believe I made some sense. I don't know. When I got 60 or 90 days, I don't know what the hell I was saying, but the last thing that I said was something about stabbing myself with a katana sword, and I had my home group to thank for that. I'm like, what the fuck? And I sat down, confused and embarrassed. Newcomers say the darndest things. And I was making friends by then, awkwardly. I went, the first time I hung out with them, I went to one of the guys' houses. I walked in the front door and froze. And he kept going. He turned around and saw me and said, what are you doing? I said, I don't know what to do next. Where's my seat? Where do I put my coat? What do I say? How do I sit? He laughed at me and very kindly brought me into the room, said, you can sit there. I slowly became more comfortable. A few months later, I ended up sponsoring him. He had 18 months, I had 6, and I don't know why. About 8 months, I had my first emotional relapse, where just what is happening and all awful and God, who, what program. And recovered by the time I got 9 months. Then went crazy again, recovered by the time I got a year. And the day I picked up my year trip at one of my groups, I was at a friend's, non-AA friend's birthday party. Lots of drinking, typical college house, like sculptures and mountains of empty bottles. I'll wrap this up really quick. And as soon as the pot came out, it's like, legitimate social purpose expired. And I went to the meeting and I picked up my chip and I had finally understood what the program had done for me. And I just said, I've lost a lot of things, gained a lot of things, but really I'm alive. And I said it with such like enthusiasm and a little anger. Like, this was hard to get. I was just surviving before. The first step talks about my life being unmanageable, and I didn't have a life. I only had an existence, my job and my car and my bills. There was no hopes or dreams. There was no future. I was just a warm body sucking down air. And that had changed, and I was happy. And people said there was the pink cloud, and I thought I was having a manic episode, but it lasted for a year. And they don't last that long. So I decided, oh, that's happiness. I was not familiar with the emotion. And I have continued to get service positions since then. I'm the chair of Swacky Paw. I was the chair of Salty Paw before that, and the third legacy for Salty Paw before that, which basically is just saying no all the time. It is incredibly frustrating sometimes. I'm surrounded by alcoholics constantly who are selfish and self-seeking. And I'm unfortunately one of them. I've gone to Al-Anon to get some coping mechanisms for it. And it's real life, which I heard described in sobriety as it gets better and then it gets worse. Then it gets different, then it gets real, then it gets real different. And that is a blessing because before it was just the same every day. It got worse, 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 the same. And there was no change every day, the groundhog thing, but really just smaller and smaller. And the only reason I got sober was because things got worse quicker than I could lower my standards. I would not stay here if I'd thought that stuff was better outside. I'm staying on a houseboat this weekend, and it's been difficult. Got a speedboat, and both of these things were gifts from my company, and the speedboat broke, and I just was feeling sorry for myself and miserable, and then I realized everybody was coming together to fix it. And at no point did anybody say a drink or a drug would make this better. I don't know if it occurred to any of them, but they certainly didn't say it out loud. And these are all of us, are people who, maybe not all, but people who wanted to die and knew how and didn't. And now happy, joyous, and free. Maybe not all three at the same time, and maybe not even one. On a particular day, but on balance more than before. And that is stunning to me, but I have to choose to remember that. And that's mainly what AA has given me, is the power to choose and the reminder to choose that things are not always as they seem, and that I can look around and see I'm surrounded by friends, I can go anywhere and say, you're my friend because you're an AA, and they're kind of compelled to agree. And I've done that. I know it to be true. And I just am really glad to have been able to speak. I didn't make it to nearly as much conference as I wanted to. But I fully expect all of you to come to Swacky Paw and go to every single panel and event. No sleeping.
Pre-reg.
And I want to thank the committee, and that is all.